Well, Lord, we come to you in the name of Jesus, and we are honored to be in your presence. We are grateful for a man the caliber of the prophet Isaiah that you sent for us 700 years before you sent your son, that you sent him in the pattern of Jesus to warn us and to promise us a life after death with you. Thank you for him. Thank you for the words that just jump out at our hearts and that quicken us, remind us to go on and do more. Oh God, let us not miss one opportunity. We know you're coming. We welcome you back, but Lord, we ask that we be ready, that we not leave one thing unturned that you asked us to do. Give us the courage to carry forth. Thank you for every person here and their willingness to learn. And we ask now that you would illumine everything that we need to see. We trust you in Jesus' name. Amen. I want to start with 1 Corinthians. It seems kind of strange when we're doing Isaiah, but Paul is one of our heroes of the faith too. In fact, we're going to watch something at the end of this where a little boy has a visit from God. And God tells him that Paul is one of the two witnesses from Revelation. We'll see. He certainly is a very good candidate. But I'm in 1 Corinthians 2, the second verse. And I want you to know that this is what my theme is for you. This is what my theme is for my life. I hope it's yours too. Taken from the Apostle Paul, 1 Corinthians 2:2. For I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I don't want to teach you anything, not one sentence, not one phrase, unless it takes you back to Jesus and him crucified. If I teach you anything else, it is for naught. I believe every book in this Bible, I believe every phrase, I believe we can point to every number, and it's all going to point to him. We are going to see Jesus all over Isaiah. We're going to see him illuminated all over Ezekiel and Joel and Micah and Obadiah and Habakkuk and Nahum. We're going to see him in the Gospels. We're going to see him in the letters and the epistles. He is all over this book. He is the Jewish author of this book, and we're going to see him today in a spot where you never thought you'd ever see him, and that's on the throne of God. Because guess what? He's not just the Son. He's God, too. And I don't understand the Trinity totally, but I get it that it's true. We're going to see him in this chapter 6 in a part where, unlike any other part of the Bible, you're going to see him illumined and lifted up, and you're going to learn some things about him. I hope that you're going to say, wow. So let's just start right in. I am in Isaiah, and I am in the very first of the fifth chapter. Now, let's just do a tiny bit of a review, and I know all of you know this, but I review for myself. You know mostly that's what I do it for. We're written in the terms of four of the Judah kings. And we are at this particular time in chapter 5 and 6, we're in the terms of King Uzziah. In fact, he's going to die in chapter 6. We're going to learn that Isaiah was a pretty wealthy guy. He came from influence. We think, according to historical documents, that he is actually the cousin of Uzziah, which makes him very, very important, and he loves Uzziah. And I will tell you this, take note of this, Judah was never as good after Uzziah died. It is a downhill slide for the kingdom of Judah once King Uzziah dies. He was a good king. You're going to find out this, that in review, Israel had a major civil war after Solomon died. You know this. This is just in way of review. And the 10 northern tribes were the most evil and the most sin-filled at the time. Remember Rehoboam and the idols they brought in? And so the northern part of that kingdom split off because the southern part, which was Simeon, the tribes of Simeon and Judah, decided they couldn't go with that. They couldn't go with idol worship. They couldn't go with the sin that went with the north. And they split off and they became just called the house of Judah. The 10 northern ones became the house of Israel. So there we have the split of the 12 tribes of Israel, but it's not like it that you think. You're going to hear some misnomers and some misrepresentations if you do very much study. And you're going to hear the famous lost tribes of Israel, and where are they? They're probably in Great Britain, and some of them are probably in America. No, they're not, because here they're not lost. What happened when the north became idolatrous and evil? And they had kings that let idols be made in high places, and the groves happened, and all that began happening in the north. The ones that were still in those 10 tribes that were worthy, that were righteous, began sifting south. So what you're going to see is the righteous began sifting south, and the unrighteous of the southern tribes that were Judah and Simeon that wanted to worship idols, they began sifting north. So there's no such thing as any lost tribes, because what happened is the natural mix began happening, so that the good ones, and I'm going to use that term loosely, went south, the evil ones went north where they could worship idols. So when you hear that, know what the people are talking about. They don't know what they're talking about. They're not lost. Number one, God wouldn't lose his people. So you have the southern group basically started with Simeon and Judah that are now intermixed with all 12 tribes. Benjamin, Naphtali, they're remnants of all of them that came south. That's what we're talking about in history. Isaiah was in the era of the southern kingdom. He reigned with four kings. King Uzziah lived 52 years, a very, very long reign for a king. It will go to show you that from then on, we're going to watch how this decreases in number of how many years they lived, how many years they reigned. And they got more evil and evil and evil and evil. And Uzziah even blows it. Let me tell you what he does. And I'm going to give you references. We're not going to read it. It's a whole nother study. Uzziah got full of himself. We saw that in King David. We saw it in Solomon. We saw it in people that knew better. Yes?
Did he live 52 years or did he reign?
He reigned 52 years.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry. I said that wrong. Uzziah got... He messed up. He's a human being. Point finger back at myself every day. I have to go back to the cross. And he decided that he was good enough to be a priest. Now, in our study of Revelation, how many people in the Bible are kings and priests? They are Jesus Christ, and they are us. Period. In the Old Testament, we only saw Melchizedek make that one short appearance with Abraham, which we think was a theophany. We thought it was really Jesus, and he was a king and priest. But kings and priests are not the same office. They don't intermix, and God is real specific about that. But Uzziah got full of himself and decided he was going to offer incense on the altar and be like a priest. And do you know what God did to him? He gave him leprosy. And in those days, leprosy was a death tag. It said, you're done. So his son Jotham tried to help him, and he died a terrible, painful death. Because God does not take lightly unrighteousness. You think that's a really bad punishment for a good king? I think God gets to make the rules. He made the rules in Leviticus about what priests did, what kings did, and they were not to cross. And Uzziah crossed the boundaries. You want to know how special you are? Let's take it back full circle. You get to do that. You get to be a priest and a king. In the immortal days, when we are in the millennium with Jesus and we're reigning, we're priests and kings with Jesus. Not my story, not my rules. And do you think I'm just tickled pink? You betcha. God took Uzziah out of the picture because he did that. That's the story of Uzziah. This is the time that we're looking at in this 5th and 6th chapter of Isaiah. Uzziah has messed up. He suffers leprosy for several years, and his son helps him reign, but he dies of it. There is no recompense for him. God, of course, forgives him, and you're going to see him in heaven because he was a good king, and he was a good man, but he did mess up. And you've got to remember, in Old Testament, they had specific rules, and he did not obey. So that's where we're setting at in the setting of Isaiah. Let's start in the 5th chapter, the first verse. Now let me sing to my well-beloved. By the way, we're going to start out with a song. You're going to find different kinds of authorship techniques of Isaiah. You're going to find some of the best writing. I told you to begin with, he's called the Shakespeare of the Old Testament, which I think is a downplay for him. He's way better than Shakespeare. And the Apostle Paul. You're going to find in 5 and 6 the gospel heart of the Old Testament right here. that talks about Jesus. You could win someone to Jesus if you took the fifth and sixth verse of Isaiah and really explained to somebody, you could win a soul to Jesus. In fact, when Philip led the eunuch to Christ, he used Isaiah. It's very easy to see. It's Jesus in every verse. And by the way, we're going to start out with a song, but I'm going to tell you, it's not a song like you think. It's not a praise song like we had. It's not a happy song like Happy Birthday. It's a dirge. It's a funeral tune. It's a requiem. It's a sad, sad song. And it's written so well, you forget how sad the words are. But I want you to think past, probably Isaiah sang it. Probably did. Very talented man. He wrote poetry, wrote songs, and this is the song he's writing. And it's a requiem mass. It's about a sad death and a terrible, awful sin. And I want to read it to you, and I'm in chapter 5. Now let me sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard. On a very fruitful hill he dug it up and cleared out its stones. Now I'm not going to be singing this. Isaiah would be. And planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst and also made a wine press in it. So he expected to bring forth good grapes. But, and that's huge, circle that word, it brought forth wild grapes. Now, you won't understand the meaning of that unless you understand what the Jewish culture and a agrarian kind of culture where they did lots of agriculture would understand immediately what he was saying. Wild grapes was like a cuss word to them. It was like you said, oh, it brought forth, because that was a curse on a field. Not unlike we get weeds today and they take over. And they just go crazy, and they suck out all the good stuff. And so it's so much more than saying it brought forth wild grapes. It was a curse on the land, and it was horrible. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, please, between me and my vineyard. Let's stop for a minute. It is important that you understand the Jewishness of this. I tried to explain to you a little bit about what this song is. It's not only a song, it's a parable. The master of parables is Jesus. We're going to go into some of his parables, and a lot of his parables are about vineyards. Wine, grapes, and vineyards are a big deal. And if you go to the valley in Jerusalem, and you see today, there's lots of vineyards. It's the most, I did a little study on the agriculture of that area. It's the best suited land in all the earth for growing grapes. The best. And God knew that. So that's what he's talking about. He's talking about a vineyard. Now, I want you to know that God wrote this. This is God talking, and I want you to listen to his words again. Isaiah is saying to you, let me sing this song about my well-beloved. Who is the well-beloved? It's Jesus, of course. Our God. A song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. And in case you're going to wonder what a vineyard is, let me do a Chuck Missler on you. There is no questions in the Bible. Everything's answered. I want you to skip ahead just for this point to verse 7. Let me tell you what God does when you think, what's he talking about? He's talking about a vineyard. Let's go to verse 7. I'm in chapter 5. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. You want to know what the vineyard is? He tells you. It says the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. There's no guessing. God explains it. And the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. Now I'm going to skip back and let's rethink this song again. This is a sad song. This has no joy in it. My beloved has a vineyard on a fruitful hill. So that's Israel. God planted Israel in a fruitful place. In fact, God dug it up and cleared out the stones. He built a tower in its midst. Now that lands towards wanting to do a word search about towers. I'm going to have Tristan read to you in Psalm 144, 1 through 3, and we're going to talk a little bit about towers, and then we're going to skip back at the vineyards. Now remember, he's got a vineyard on a fruitful hill, and right in the center is a tower. So let's see what God says a tower is, because it's always explained in the Bible. We're in Psalm 144, 1 through 3.
Blessed be the Lord, my strength, which teaches my hands to war, my fingers to fight. My goodness and my fortress, my high tower, my deliverer, my shield, and he in whom I trust. who subdueth my people under me. For what is man that thou takest knowledge of him, or the son of man that thou makest account of him?
So who is your high tower? Well, of course, it's Jesus. And God has made in the middle of his people a tower of strength. Proverbs said, the Lord God is my high tower. I run to him and I'm safe. So in the middle of this people of Israel, he's placed a tower. Let's do a little bit, going back now, we're going to look at the vineyard word a little bit. And we're going to do some searches in the New Testament. Because I've told you one time that you can't separate the Old and New Testament. It's really a shame that whoever divided the book didn't just keep it up going. It's not chronological anyway. It really isn't. John says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. That should be the very first verse in the Bible. So it's not really chronological. Why didn't they just weave it all together? Because we're going to do that. We're looking at we're going to go to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We're going to do the parables about the vineyard, and we're going to bring it back to show you that Isaiah was telling the same story that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, 700 years later, was told by Jesus. So let's go to Matthew first.
Okay, Matthew 21:33-41. Hear another parable. There was a certain householder which planted a vineyard, and hedged it round about, and digged a wine press in it, and built a tower, and let it out to husbandmen, and went into a far country. And when the time of the fruit drew near, he sent his servants to the husbandmen, that they might receive the fruits of it. And the husbandman took his servant, and beat one, killed another, and stoned another. Again he sent other servants more than the first, and likewise did unto them likewise. But last of all he sent unto them his son, saying, they will reverence my son. But when the husbandmen saw the son, they said among themselves, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and let us seize on his inheritance. And they caught him and cast him out of the vineyard and slew him. When the Lord thereof of the vineyard cometh, what will he do unto those husbandmen?
And let's think about what Isaiah was saying. This is a sad song. He's saying God has a vineyard out in Israel. And Matthew says, and he sent his son to this vineyard. Sent his son to Israel, and what'd they do to him? Okay, let's go see what Mark says about the same parable. We're talking about vineyards. We're talking about the house of Israel.
Mark 12:1-9. And he began to speak unto them by parables. A certain man planted a vineyard, and set a hedge about it, and dug a place for the wine fat, and built a tower, and let it out to the husbandmen, and went into a far country. And at the season he sent the husbandman a servant, that he might receive from the husbandman of the fruit of the vineyard. And they caught him and beat him, and sent him away empty. And again he sent unto them another servant. At him they cast stones, and wounded him in the head, and sent him away shamefully handled. And again he sent another, and him they killed, and many others, beating some and killing some. Having yet therefore one son, his well-beloved, he sent him also last unto them, saying, they will reverence my son. But those husbandmen said among themselves, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance shall be ours. And they took him and killed him and cast him out of the vineyard. What shall therefore the Lord of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the husbandmen, and will give the vineyard unto others.
And it's interesting that Mark used the exact same phrase that Isaiah does. My well-beloved. Mark uses the exact same Greek words, identical. Same story. House of Israel. The son comes. What happens? Let's see the very last parallel of that in Luke.
Luke 20:9-19. Then he began to speak to the people this parable. A certain man planted a vineyard, and led it forth to the husbandman, and went into the far country for a long time. And at the season he sent a servant to the husbandman, that they should give him of the fruit of the vineyard. But the husbandman beat him, and sent him away empty. And again he sent another servant, and they beat him also, and entreated him shamefully, and sent him away empty. And again he sent a third, and they wounded him also, and cast him out. Then said the Lord of the vineyard, what shall I do? I will send my beloved son. It may be they will reverence him when they see him. But when the husbandmen saw him, they reasoned among themselves, saying, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, that the inheritance may be ours." So they cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. What therefore shall the Lord of the vineyard do unto them? He shall come and destroy these husbandmen, and shall give the vineyard to others. And when they heard it, they said, "God forbid." And he beheld them and said, "What is this then that if is written, 'The stone which the builders rejected, the same is become the head of the corner'? Whosoever shall fall upon that stone shall be broken, but on whomsoever it shall fall, it will grind him to powder."
Anybody seeing a parallel yet? Let me pull one more Old Testament voice into this discussion so that you understand what God's saying about the vineyard. I'm in Psalm 80, and I'm going to start with the 14th verse, Psalm 80, 14. "Return, we beseech you, O God of hosts. Look down from heaven and see and visit this vine and the vineyard which your right hand has planted." Who planted Israel as a nation? They came up out of Egypt, a massive millions of fugitives from Pharaoh up out of Egypt, and they became a nation right then. God planted them. "And the vineyard which your right hand has planted, and the branch that you made strong for yourself." Who's the branch? Always Jesus. "It is burned with fire. It is cut down. They perish at the rebuke of your countenance. Let your hand be upon the man of your right hand, upon the son of man whom you made strong for yourself. Then we will not turn back from you. Revive us, and we will call upon your name." That is the same story David saw. So let's go back and let's review then a little bit. "My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. He dug it up and cleared out its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst and made a wine press in it. So he expected it. He expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, please, between me and my vineyard." This is the only place in the Bible that you're going to see God telling people to judge him. If you didn't know this existed, read it. I am in the third verse of the fifth chapter. And this is God speaking again. "Now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, please, between me and my vineyard." What more could have been done to my vineyard that I have not done in it? God's asking you, judge me. I brought you up out of Egypt. I gave you the choicest land that the Canaanite giants were in, and I sent people in there with mighty power like Joshua and Caleb, and you rousted those giants. And I gave you the best possible place on a fruitful hill to plant your people and be well and fruitful. And what did you do? You turned on me. You put up idols. You worship cats and you worship cows. You built groves of trees and you worshiped Astaroth and all Baal and Moloch. You burnt your babies on their arms. What more could I have done? God is saying, I rescued you. I loved you as my beloved. He calls him my beloved. And God asks the question. It's like you're in a court of law and he's saying, judge me. Have you ever seen God ask that before? It's the only place in the Bible I know of that he says this. Judge, please, between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done to my vineyard that I have not done in it? And a righteous God could ask that, because he knew well there was nothing else. Why then, when I expected it to bring forth good grapes, did it bring forth wild grapes? And now please let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard, because the rest of the story is this. There's a price to pay. You think the flip side of sin is fun? Flip it over. Here's what God says he's going to do. Pay attention. And he even warned you, starting in verse 5, "And now please let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard." Who's the vineyard? It's his people. Here's what he's going to do to Israel. Never discount the promises of God. And this is a promise. Here's what he's going to do. I'm in verse 6. "I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned or dug. But there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they will rain no more on it." So it's going to be dry and dusty and weedy and fruitless. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice, but behold, oppression, for righteousness, but behold, a cry for help. Let's talk about something here. Tristan, will you read to us in Genesis 3:18? I'm referring to now where he's talking about briars and thorns. It's about halfway in the sixth verse where God says, I will lay it waste, it shall not be pruned or dug, but there shall come up briars and thorns. He promises that one other place in the Bible, I think, is an interesting tie-in here. Genesis 3:18.
Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field.
This is when Adam and Eve messed up, and he sent them out of the garden. He said, I'm going to promise you thorns. And you know what? God gave Israel a new chance. He started them as a new people out of Egypt. He said, you're my people, you're my nation. Promised Abraham that they were going to be a mighty nation. But you know what? He's bringing the thorns back in. I think that's pretty interesting. I am in verse 8. We're going to start a section now. In fact, chapter 5 often is called the woes of Isaiah, because we're going to do a section now where we are going to take a sideline trip down the woes of Israel. These are the sins and what's going to happen. And God's going to, in case you ever wondered what they did wrong, he's going to spell it out. It is my total belief that the more I study is that there are no unbeknowns in the Bible. There are no, I can't get that, I'm guessing on this. If you don't know it, search a little deeper, because he's going to tell you. And he never meant for this book to be a mystery. He did not. We're going to find in the parable section that Tristan read, Jesus at a certain part, and about halfway through Matthew, I think it's maybe about the 12th or 13th chapter, Jesus quit talking to the Pharisees and the Sadducees straight on. They accused him of being in a nice term, an illegitimate child. They said it a little more coarsely. And he turned on them like a viper. And he said, you brood of vipers. And from that point on, he spoke never to the Pharisees and Sadducees in real words. He spoke to them only in parables. And his disciples asked him about that. Why are you doing that? He said, because I came that they would not understand. Hearing they will not hear, and seeing they will not see. And we're going to see those exact words in Isaiah. But from then on in Jesus' ministry, he never spoke to them a direct answer. It was always in parables. That's why it's interesting to see Isaiah 700 years before Jesus use that same parable of the vineyard. But what's going to happen is we're going to see what God is saying is going to happen to Israel because of their sins. Anyway, it's called the woes of Isaiah. And I am starting. Let's finish up. I'm going to reread 7 just a little bit, half of it for you, and then we're going to go right into the woes, and we're going to explain each one. I'm in about halfway through the 7th verse. He looked for justice, but behold oppression, for righteousness, but behold a cry for help. And then we start the woe section, and I am in verse 8. Woe to those who join house to house. If you want to remember the woe section, we saw a real part happen in Revelation when the angel or bird or whatever it was, some people thought it was an eagle, flew across heaven saying, whoa, 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 warning that the things were coming, like earthquakes and all that. And that set up a real catastrophic setting for events to be really bad. That's what's happening here. It's the same exact Greek word, woe, means sin or a judgment is coming. And somebody said in the modern language, if you wanted to just be kind of vernacular, you could say, wow, it's coming, but God uses woe. So woe to those who join house to house. They add field to field till there is no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land. In my hearing, the Lord of hosts said, truly, many houses shall be desolate, great and beautiful ones without inhabitant, for 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield one ephah. Let's talk about that. It's very Jewish. It is not that God does not want you to own houses or land. It is not that. Let's surface. Let's look at what he's really saying. He's saying this. He's saying if you get so consumed with materialism that all you think about is what can I buy next? What can I add to this? How can I fix this? And you don't put him any place in the mix. It's always about where you put God. It's never that he doesn't want you to have things. I truly believe that the Father that loves us, like we are with our kids, we want him to have great things. We just want him to love us. He wants you to love and worship him. So we're going to kind of name this first woe a grasp at materialism. You can name it whatever you want to. You can say putting things too much, but I think materialism is a pretty good explanation for that. And what it also says is that if you have so much, you get consumed by that, you don't have time to think about him. Tristan, could you look up Micah 2:1? Yep. And we're going to talk. Micah is a real interesting prophet who's prophesying at the same time. He lives at the same time Isaiah does, and he basically is telling the same story. And he's a little bit more vocal. He's a shorter book. He doesn't write down as much, but he's louder even. Isaiah can be poetic, and he can write songs and dirges, and he can write poetry, and Micah just blurts it out. So Micah, we're going to look at him, and remember, he's one of the minor prophets. We're looking at Micah 2:1.
Woe to them that devise iniquity and work evil upon their beds. When the morning is light, they practice it, because it is the power of their hand.
Exactly the same thing that Isaiah said. You spend so much time making so much money and buying houses and things that you don't think about me. Woe to you. That's woe one. I'm going to head on to woe two, and I'm in the 11th verse. This will be woe two. Woe to those who rise early in the morning. And first thing I read that, I went, this is me. But you got to read the rest of it to know it's not. Because those of you that know me, the 4 a.m. bit, that's true. But now listen to the rest and it won't fit. That they may follow intoxicating drink. So you got to read the whole story. That's not me.
No, wait. This is strong drink. Is that coffee?
Mine says intoxicating. So sorry. I'm in New King James, so. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue until night till wine inflames them. The harp and the strings, the tambourine and the flute, the wine are in their feasts, but they do not regard the work of the Lord nor consider the operation of his hands. Therefore my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. Their honorable men are famished and their multitude dried up with thirst. Therefore Sheol has enlarged itself and opened its mouth. Beyond measure, their glory and their multitude and their pomp, and he who is jubilant shall descend into it. Now that's a lot. Woe too is this. If I want to nutshell it down, drunken pleasure seeking. Woe to that. He's not against you getting up early in the morning. He's not against you probably even having a strong drink. Although I will tell you the truth, for me, I don't. I'm not going to make that decision for you. I don't see one time in the Bible it says, good for you if you drink wine, and good for you if you do this. I just see bad things. So for me, I've made that decision a long time ago, and I'm okay with this. But this is definitely against the drunken pleasure seeking. It's about drinking, and it's not against harps and strings and tambourines and flutes. He's against all that goes with drinking, and usually that's partying and bar hopping and dancing with people that you shouldn't be, and it's a lot that I think if you looked into modern America, you could say the bar scene. What it kind of sounds like me, like ancient Isaiah's bar scene is what he's saying. You can kind of turn that however you want to, but I think the carousing, drunken, pleasure seeking kind of thing is woe too. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And then he talks in 14. I want to bring a point about 14. Therefore Sheol has enlarged itself and opened its mouth beyond measure. We learned about Sheol in Revelation. That's death in the grave. He's saying this kind of living will kill you. It will take you down to Sheol. That's verse 14. So that is woe too. And you can label that however you want to. But God's not pleased with it. I'm going to continue on in 15. People shall be brought down. Each man shall be humbled. And the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. But the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment. He's saying a strange dichotomy there. Think just what he said in that verse. Verse 16. Put a star by it and see if this makes sense to you. But the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment. That just sounds, and when I first read that, I thought, he's taking pleasure in judgment. No, he's not. He's not pleased with it, but he's exalted by it because he is righteous and he can't have it any other way. He can't let this go by or he wouldn't be God. And when he brings down the hammer because he said he would, he is God. It's his rules and he gets to make them. And that's what 16 says. Then number 17, then the lamb shall feed in their pasture and in waste places of the fat one stranger shall eat. If you remember back to Revelation when the earth is destroyed and Damascus is flattened, especially in Isaiah 17, we're going to see Damascus flattened. Nothing can inhabit there anymore except the sheep will graze there. And that's always the last sign of the end of a civilization, that nothing lives there but the sheep graze. And I think it goes back to a full circle about who is the shepherd? Jesus. And you know what? He gets to have the final say. That's just how it works. Well, we're ready for woe three. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of vanity and sin as if with a cart rope. And they say, let him make speed and hasten his work that we may see it. And let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come that we may know it. Now, this one was a hard one to understand. Tristan, would you read Job 8, 14?
Job 8.
Job. And nobody really loves studying Job. But we are going to bring him in for a reference here.
Whose hope shall be cut off, and whose trust shall be a spider's web?
Okay, why am I doing that spider's web? Let's take this full circle. I want to explain it to you. I had to do some historical looking for this one. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of vanity and sin as if it were with a cart rope. In those days, especially in the northern tribes, they were worshiping Baal. The feast days for Baal, and I really have a feeling that that last row where there was tambourines and dancing were feast days for Baal. I really think that's what he was talking about, although it could be any drunken partying. But when they had feast days for Baal, they typically had carts that they decorated. Remind me, if you could say, like a parade today. And they would make these big carts, and they'd put stuff on there that they were going to give to Baal. I assume they were fruits and things that God would normally ask for, the first fruits of your crops and all that. And they made big carts and they decorated them. They pulled them with big ropes down the street and they made it a big ta-da about it. That's what he's talking about. He's saying you are making a defiant sinfulness in God's face. You're not only worshiping Baal and Moloch and some of these Astaroth and some of these others. You are making parades, and you're having music, and you're making big carts, and you have these huge ropes that are so laden with stuff for this other god that you can't just have spider webs like Job said, little tiny spider webs. That's why we brought Job in. You have to have big cart ropes to carry all your treasures for this other god. And I think what that is saying these people are doing it in God's face. It's not unlike people today that are so off in their worship and in their lifestyle, they live it right out loud and just say, God, just suck it up. You're just going to have to take it. And God's saying, uh-uh. Woe to you. So I've labeled this one defiant sinfulness because that's in your face to God. And the big cart ropes, you had to understand what that meant. I hope, does that make sense to you? Does that explain it a little bit better what that was? Because that one I had to do some searching on. And then I'm on the next woe, and I am starting on verse 20. And this should be woe 4. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And I think you could write right across that America. Evil for good. It's okay if you live with somebody. You don't have to marry him. It's okay. By the way, if you want to live with a guy or a girl, it's all good. There's no right or wrong. It's all good. You want to murder a baby that's 9 months, just hasn't quite come out yet, just kill it first. That's okay. We don't call that murder. That baby was a blobber piece of tissue or whatever you want to call it. It's okay. It's all good. Whoa, God says. And I called this moral degradation. It's a decline of the morals. And I think Isaiah saw it. John saw it. Ezekiel saw it. Peter saw it. I mean, I can take you Old and New Testament. People haven't changed. God sent his son in this vineyard for these people. He's telling them, 700 years ago, I'm sending you my son and you're going to kill him. And you're going to drape up sin and call it good and you're going to make everything okay. And it's not. And that's moral degradation. And I believe that's woe for. And I think you can write America across that big, big, big. And I am in verse 21, which will take us to the fifth woe. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. And that's pretty short and sweet to the punch. I think that can be called arrogant conceit. I think we have a president who thinks that what he says doesn't have to have laws or rules. And I use him as an example. There's 100 up there. There's 100, and sometimes I'm that one. And I don't want to be. So I point my finger back at myself and say, don't do that. That's a woe. And that was woe 5. The next one is woe 6. It starts in the 22nd verse. Woe to men mighty at drinking wine. You know how many times he talks about strong drink and wine? It's a bad deal. Woe to men valiant for mixing intoxicating drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away justice from the righteous man. That one was a little bit harder to understand too. And we almost have to go into the original language to get what that means. By the way, heroes and valiant men, that root word actually translates to leaders. He's talking about the leaders here. And what he's saying is dishonest leaders, corrupt leadership. Woe, woe, woe. If you're a leader of anything and you're corrupt, he's pointing at you. Because that's what those root words mean. Could be leader of a country, could be leader of a company. And he's saying, whoa. And you mix drinks with that, it's even worse. I don't know how many of you watched the videos of some of these high rollers that got caught being on these conventions, spending all of the government's money in there, sitting in hot tubs and drinking. That's the first thing I thought of when I read that. I thought, oh, Isaiah saw that 700 years ago. But that's what he's saying. You deceitful drinking leaders. You unhonest, stupid people that we're paying you to do this, and that's what, and really Isaiah saw that, and I'm in verse 13. Therefore, my people have gone into captivity, and I want you to circle therefore. When God says therefore, stamp it done, it's over. He's saying in verse 13, all these woes have happened. Well, here's the payback. Therefore, my people have gone into captivity, not are going to, not I'm going to change my mind, not they might, I might reprieve them. He says it's happening. The northern tribes at this point have already been taken, and the Assyrian king is on the doorstep trying right now to come in at King Hezekiah's spot. Because Uzziah's dead, remember? Jotham only reigns a little bit, and then Hezekiah comes in. And that Assyrian king gets ready to come in, and Hezekiah, and they all get scared, and they start praying. But he says, it's done. I may give you a little bit of a reprieve, but you're gone. Therefore, my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. Have you ever heard that? My people perish for lack of knowledge. Gee, I think we've heard that before. Their honorable men are famished and their multitude dried up with thirst. Remember in the part about the agrarian vineyard? He said, I'm going to dry it up. I'm going to shut down the clouds. There's not going to be any rain. You're not going to have any water to drink. You're going to be thirsty in your soul and you're going to be thirsty in your body because you did not honor me. And my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. And I think it's even more than they have no knowledge. When he says it like that, they have no desire for any more knowledge. They don't want to know the truth. How many leaders do you know now, and let's take it to today, want to know the truth? How many people do you even know that want to know the truth about the Bible really? And you say to them, you know, truly, John says in Revelation 2 and 3 that 5/7 of the churches probably aren't going to get raptured. How well does that go over with your friends? Can anyone disagree with that statement? Now, you have to do a little studying to get there, and you have to read each of the letters to the churches and see what he says is going to happen. There's one, he says, you will go through the wrath. And there's one that says, you absolutely will escape the wrath. But 5 of them are real iffy. And when you start saying that to people, just like these people in Isaiah, they don't want to know that. They want to go on partying. They want to keep sleeping with their neighbor. They want to keep drinking lots of drinks from morning till night. That's what Isaiah says, not me. They want to be leaders and be corrupt and go party and use the company jet and make you pay for it and go sit in hot tubs and drink tequila. I mean, you name it. Isaiah saw the same story. Has things changed? No, they haven't. Does it make me angry? Yes, it makes me angry because I want to say, God. And let's point fingers back at ourselves. What am I to learn from this? And God says, don't do this. These are woes. Don't do this and don't do this. And he gave you six things not to do. Here's your plan for this week. You got six things he doesn't want you to do, and they're spelled out. If you need me to give you those short terms again, I can give them to you. But it's pretty simple. He said, don't do it, or you're going to go into captivity, and I'm not relenting. That's what he says. He says, therefore, Sheol has enlarged itself and opened its mouth. And we've already talked about that Sheol thing. It's death. So we've done the woes, and now we're going to look at... death and the grave. It's not actually hell. The Jewish people believed that when you died, they had a strange belief. It's not actually hell. The lake of fire.
Isaiah saw today with everybody doing this, God saying you guys are going to hell.
Yeah, that's what it would be as if we were today. So we finished the woe section. I'm going to start now on verse 24. Therefore, as the fire devours the stubble and the flame consumes the chaff, so their root will be as rottenness and their blossom will ascend like dust because, here's the big because, and I don't miss this. It's halfway through 24. Because they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One. God says two reasons that he's going to punish. Because they have rejected the law and despised the word. You know why people are perishing? They don't know the word. They didn't know the word in Isaiah's day either. And I'm in verse 25. Therefore, the anger of the Lord is aroused against his people. Here's what got me about this. Who is this whole lesson to? He's writing to Judah and Jerusalem. He's not writing to the Assyrians, the Canaanites, the Hebusites, the Hivites. He's not writing to them. He's writing to Judah and Jerusalem. That's who Isaiah writes to. And he says, therefore, the anger of the Lord is aroused against his own people. Can God get mad at you? You betcha. Are you his? Yeah. Can he get mad at you? You do these six woes, he can. Because he's doing it to the Israelites. I think we need to do a heads up here. He has stretched out his hand against them and stricken them, and the hills trembled. By the way, we see that same trembling in Revelation 6. It's called an earthquake, and we also see it in Zechariah 14, Amos 1. They're all seeing. Do you want to know why the tribulation happens? This is why you've got to know what you know, what you know, and you know it from Revelation. You learned it, and you know it. The tribulation is not for you. Point to yourself and say, it's not for me. It's for God's chosen people. I'm sorry, you're not it. You are his beloved bride. You are his purchase price bought at a ransom price of Calvary. You are his church. You are his body, but you are not his chosen people. And here's what happens to his chosen people. I'm going to read it again to you, and I'm going to give you the three references that also. Therefore, the anger of the Lord is aroused against his people. He has stretched out his hand against them and stricken them, and the hills trembled. Revelation 6, Amos 1:1, and Zechariah 14:5, they all saw that same story. And the earth begins to shake in the tribulation. In Revelation 6, the whole scroll of the sky is rolled up and the earth shakes. Some people think changes axis because God is so mad at his people. But he loves them. And remember the end of the story, a third of them get it right. But at this point, Isaiah is now stepping 2,000 years into the future and saying, I'm seeing the earth trembling. God's so mad. He is mad. He's righteously mad. Read those woes. They make him sick. And I am the end of verse 25. For all his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. And here is the beauty of God. Read the dichotomy of that verse. For all his anger is not turned away. He's mad. But his hand is stretched out still. He will lift up a banner to the nations from afar. Now think Assyria and think Babylon, because those are the two nations that are going to come over and take over Israel. Assyria is coming from the north. And Babylon's coming in from the south. And here's what happens. It's really colorful. You're going to love the way Isaiah writes this. And now he's talking about God. He will lift up a banner to the nations from afar and will whistle to them from the end of the earth, going, come on down, guys. You can take over my people. Surely they shall come with speed swiftly. No one will be weary or stumble among them. Listen to the descriptions of the enemy. No one will slumber or sleep, nor will the belt on their loins be loosened, or the strap of their sandals be broken, whose arrows are sharp and their bows bent. Their horses' hoofs will seem like flint, and their wheels like a whirlwind. Their roaring will be like a lion. By the way, Peter says, who walks around like a roaring lion, seeking to whom he may devour? Do you remember that? Peter sees Satan like that. You think these Assyrian, Nebuchadnezzarish, Babylonians, evil people that are coming to take over Israel are controlled by Satan? You betcha. You think God's using him for his goodwill to punish his people? You bet he is. But they're still controlled by Satan. Whose arrows are sharp and their bows bent, their horses' hoofs will seem like flint and their wheels like a whirlwind. Their roaring will be like a lion. They will roar like young lions. Satan, can we say? They will roar and lay hold of the prey. They will carry it away safely, and no one will deliver. In that day they will roar against them like the roaring of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold, darkness and sorrow. Does that sound to you like Jesus is coming? Does he bring darkness and sorrow? Of course not! This is the enemy. But God's using them to take Israel captive to prove a point. And the light darkened by the clouds. And if you want to think about chapter 5, it's often called the Book of Woes. It's often called God wants them to return, but he is righteous. And the thing I've learned too about Isaiah is that he literally believes in a benevolence of God. He does. He's the one that first tells us about the virgin birth. He's the one that uses the word Messiah more than any other Old Testament author. And he tells about Jesus over and over again. But he got stuck with a real crummy deal. I thought about being Isaiah and I thought, here's this kind of wealthy young man who's well-liked among the court. The priests like him. The kings like him. He's probably very nice. God loves him. He trusts him with a lot. And yet he's got to tell a really horrible message to his people. Isaiah's not telling this to foreigners. He's bringing this message to his friends and saying, woe to you, woe to you, woe to you, and woe to you. And if you don't stop, God's bringing these guys in, and they're going to sift you like fire. And they're going to step on you with their horses' hoofs are like flint. Their horses' hoofs are going to cut you like sharp rock, and you're going to be taken away from here. And he's telling this to his friends. I don't think we understand what he had to go through. We're going to see one place in chapter 6 where he's really undone, and he's going to remind you a little bit of John. So let's go on to chapter 6, and I again apologize for the length of this. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had six wings, and two he covered his face, and two he covered his feet, and two he flew. There are some thoughts about, you will not see seraphim any place else in the Bible. Ezekiel sees the cherubim, and they're similar. They're not the same. We know there's lots of different angelic beings. These are angels. They're the only place that anyone gets to see them is Isaiah. And Isaiah saw the Lord lifted up. He got to go into the heavenlies. I want to step back just a minute and talk a little bit about King Uzziah. King Uzziah was a good king. If you're interested in his life, I'm going to give you some references. They're in 2 Chronicles, the 26th chapter. and the 28th chapter. And they tell he's a very good king. He is successful in his business. He's successful in army things, and he's successful in his life. But he made a really tragic error, and it cost him. What do I think we take away from that? I think we watch what we do. I think we know God's word. I think we stay in it, and I think we're just really, really careful. By the way, at this point in time, Tiglath-Pileser III is the Assyrian king that is looming large in the horizons. Tiglath-Pileser I and II have died. They were his father and grandfather, and they had carried away the northern tribes. So this third in the rule of the Assyrian kings is right here. So that's where we're at. So Isaiah saw God. Now, you're probably already in your mind, you might be thinking, now, wait a minute. It is said in the Bible that no one can see God and live. That is true. It is said that. Tristan, would you pull up Job 26 and 9? I'm going to prove to you that some other people saw God, and then we're going to explain what that means. Different people for your reference that actually saw God besides Isaiah. Isaiah said, I saw him. In the year our king Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. I want you to note the word the Lord. That's the key there. So would you read Job to us, Tristan? We are in Job 26, 9.
He holdeth back the face of his throne and spreadeth his cloud upon it.
Okay, so Job got to see the cloud pulled away, and he got to see it. King David actually gets a glimpse of the Lord, too. And I'm going to turn to Psalm, and I'm in the 9th chapter. By the way, that's quite a study to watch David, the different ways he goes in his life. And he does turn his life around, which I'm so glad. I'm in Psalm 9, and I'm in verse 4. For you have maintained my right and my cause. You sat on the throne, judging in righteousness. We're going to look at the throne of God. If you look at Isaiah 6 again, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. And the train of his robe filled the temple. So he saw God, and God was sitting on the throne. Now, no man shall see God and live. Let's pull up. Tristan, would you read Exodus 33:20? And I want you to know where I'm getting that from. I'm not just pulling that out of the sky. We're in Exodus. By the way, who wrote Exodus? Moses. We're in good company here. Exodus 33:20. Let's see what Moses says about this.
And he said, thou canst not see my face, for there shall be no man see me and live.
All right. God told Moses, you can't see my face. Remember when he's hiding in the cleft of the rock, which of course was Jesus. Now I want to explain this to you, and then we're not going to labor this because I gave you other references you can look at. Here's how we rectify this. We believe there is a Trinity. I believe there's a Trinity. I believe I can prove it to you in the Bible. God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit. Let's see what John the Beloved says in the 12th chapter of the 41st verse. These things Isaiah said. Gee, John is talking about Isaiah. These things Isaiah said when he saw his glory and spoke of him. I want to remind you. Let's go back to Isaiah 6:1, and this will clear it up. John explained it. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, not God the Father. Who is Isaiah seeing sitting on this throne? He's saying, John says, it's him. It's Jesus. And the word use of Lord there is the second person in the Trinity. Isaiah's not looking on the face of God the Father. He's looking at Jesus 700 years before he was born, and he didn't know his first name, but he knew he was Lord. Good for him. I saw the Lord sitting on the throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. That train is what gave me some real insights this week. I think you're going to like this. I know that people think of the train as like a bridal train, and it's long, and that's true, but it's really big in the Bible, and it's a lot more than that. It means hem, or it's a strip of a garment at the very bottom of a garment, and it always means authority. And for instance, in 1 Samuel 24, I'm not going to have you read that story because we're going to run out of time, but I want to remind you, David was running from King Saul, who was always chasing him. And King Saul went into a cave to use the bathroom. Let's just be vernacular here. And David was hiding in that cave and could have killed him. But David knew that he wore the robe of authority. And he cut off the bottom of that robe. And you can go back in 1 Samuel 24, 1 through 22 and read the whole story. And he took that, and Saul did not know it. And when Saul came to kill him and to chase him, David came out and showed him this and said, "Oh, king, I could have killed you in this cave." That meant a whole lot more than a piece of fabric. The bottom of the robe was authority. In fact, this is the Jewishness that we don't often know about. When people went to buy property, they had clay tablets laid out that were soft. The man would take the hem of his garment, which had his emblem, and stamp that clay that was still soft, and that would be a seal of authority. It meant a lot to the Jewish people. It was called a mantle. It was called, sometimes it was tasseled, sometimes it was bordered. They believed Jesus wore one that was rather square across his shoulder and had tassels that hung down. Also the same word for train, and let me tell you why that's important. Anyone remember the story about when Jesus was called to go to Jairus' daughter to raise her from the dead? And he turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garment?" Remember the woman with the issue of blood? She touched his train. She touched the mantle tassel part that was the authority represented for a Jew. He knew it immediately. In fact, I thought, what a strange story. I never understood that. I get it now. Let's talk about this train. You need to understand what this is. For instance, we know in Ruth, in the story of Ruth, and all these are referenced for you so you can look at them. When Ruth went to claim Boaz, or she was, you know, wanted Boaz as her husband, Naomi told her, "You go in when he's asleep on the grain at night in the storage bin, and you pull up his train, his cloth, and you cover your feet with that." That's the authority of him. That's ownership of him. That meant, that wasn't sexual and it wasn't sexy or anything like that. It wasn't flirty or anything. It was, that was Naomi saying, that way you'll be telling him that you want him to be your kinsman redeemer, and that is his mantle or his train over you. I'm going to take you back to where we're at in Isaiah in a minute. Joseph's coat of many colors in Genesis 37 was not just a coat. By his father making him this coat and putting this embroidery on the bottom, it told his brothers, the authority of my lineage is going through Joseph. It wasn't just a jealousy thing. It's about the bottom and the hem of that coat. I think the one that really got me was the one where the woman touched it with the issue of blood and she was instantly healed. There's something about the authority of that, and the Jews understood it. Now, this is something you could look up. We're not going to spend a lot of time, but it's very intriguing. It has been curious to me for a while when John the Baptist came on the scene. Several people referenced him as Elijah. In fact, John 1, 19 through 23, Jesus says, points to him and references him as Elijah. Now, let me take you full circle about with this. The mantle that Elisha actually had, mantle means train, means the long with the thing on the bottom. Elisha, when he left, Elijah, when he left, Elisha kept saying, "I want your mantle. I want you to give me your mantle." That was his cloth piece that he was wearing. And Elijah told Elisha, "Well, okay, if you're here when God comes for me, you can have it." And he got it. Well, Jewish historians believe that that piece of cloth, that mantle, that train, was actually saved and kept. And the Jewish priest had it folded so that when Zechariah came to pray and John the Baptist had not been born, that the priest gave that mantle, which was Elijah's, over to John the Baptist's father and said, "Wrap the baby in this." That's Jewish historians. Jesus referred to him several times as Elijah. You see Elijah. It's in John 1, and there are several other references. I'm just telling you, when you do a study of the word train, so let's go back then to what, I hope that gave, and there's a lot, I mean, you could study each one of these all week. But I want you to know that this is really important. So let's look again then at what actually Isaiah is seeing. He's seeing Jesus. Now let's place it in the right. In the year King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. Let's say I saw Jesus sitting on the throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. It's saying, this is what it's saying in a nutshell in the Jewishness of it. He has the authority to be God. His train, his garment has the stamp on the bottom that makes him God. Do you see it now? Does that make more sense to you? Above it, and we know about the seraphim. And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. And we can reference that to lots of times in smoke, God's fire. We see heaven, there's always smoke and fire, we know that. And here's another woe. This is what happens to Isaiah when he sees this. Woe to me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. He didn't see God the Father. Who did he see? He sees Jesus. It makes more sense when you realize who he saw. Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand the live coal, which he had taken the tongs from the altar, and he touched my mouth with it and said, behold, this has touched your lips. Your iniquity is taken away and your sin is purged. Lips are often in the Bible warned about what they say. Think about this. The seraphim flies over to the altar, takes a hot coal, and puts it on Isaiah's lips. Wow. Whoa. It's symbolic, and yet I think it really happened. He's saying, I can clean you up. By the altar, by the sacrifice of God, we can make you clean and free. Then I said, here I am. Okay. Also, I heard the voice of the Lord saying. Now, this is after he got his lips cleaned up. Then the Lord speaks. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send? And who will go for us? Please circle that us. If you ever believed in the Trinity, it's right there. It's in two-letter word, us. I saw one person sitting there according to what Isaiah says, but the Lord speaking and said, who will go for us? I love it. Then I said, this is Isaiah speaking, here I am, send me. And he said, go and tell this people. Now, you're going to hear this used all the time about missions. And they say, who will go? Go and tell me. But I want you to hear what the Lord wants Isaiah to say. And Tris, I want you to read starting 9 and read clear to the end.
Okay. And he said, go and tell this people, hear ye indeed, but understand not, and see ye indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert, and be healed. Then said I, Lord, how long? And he answered, until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate. And the Lord have removed men far away, and there be a great forsaking in the midst of the land. But yet in it shall be a tenth, and it shall return, and shall be eaten as a tale tree, and as an oak, whose substance is in them. When they cast their leaves, so the holy seed shall be the substance thereof.
And here's the rest of the story for chapters 5 and 6. Yeah, there's a reckoning coming. Yes, there is. And it's way overdue, and it's deserved. Yes, it is. Sin has a real price that it ejects. But what it is we see Jesus. We see him on his throne. And we see with his long train that he has a right to be there, that it is stamped with his mark, that he has the authority to be on the throne of God and to exact punishment. If you remember, the tribulation is called the wrath of the Lamb. And he has a right to do it. And yet, in all this, we're going to see the mercy. And the last mercy is this. Reading 12 again. The Lord has removed men far away. He's taken them. Assyria's come and taken them. Babylon's coming and taking them, and they deserve it. And the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. But yet, and here's the big ta-da for chapter 6. But yet, a tenth will be in it. There's always going to be a remnant. God's always going to have a remnant to stay true to him, and that's the hope. And will return and will be for consuming as a terebinth tree or the oak whose stump. These are the strong, big trees we've talked about. And he's going to relate the holy seed, the remnant, to a stump that has still some life in it that's still going to grow at the end. You want to know the story of Isaiah 5 and 6? Clean up your act. Stay true to God and hold on for dear life because there's a shaking coming. Make sure that you are not one of the ones that gets left behind, because this story for Israel will be your story if you don't get raptured. And it is not going to be fun. And we've studied it in Revelation, and Isaiah has a little bit more poetic way of saying it than John did, but it is the same story. Keep your lips clean, don't do any of the six woes, and keep your eyes focused on Jesus. If you want to know a few promises that I think we saw, the two promises that I saw in this, I saw Isaiah 5:16. And I want you to mark this as one of the promises, because we had a lot of punishments. And 5:16 says, "But the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God who is holy shall be hallowed in righteousness." And the last promise I saw was in 6:13 that says this, "But yet a tenth will be in it." Those are the two promises and the takeaways from these two chapters. In Jeremiah 31, 3-5, it says this, "Lord hath appeared of old unto me, saying, Yea, I have loved thee with an everlasting love. Therefore with loving kindness have I drawn thee. Again I will build thee, and thou shalt be built, O virgin of Israel." This is the remnant that he saves. "Thou shalt again be adorned with thy tablets, and shalt go forth in dances of them that make merry. Thou shalt yet plant vines." This is the millennium. "Upon the mountains of Samaria, the planters shall plant and shall eat them as common things." This vineyard gets shook. This vineyard in Jeremiah gets restored in the millennium. In Psalm 13, David says, "But I have trusted in your mercy. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me." And then I like Solomon in Proverbs 4, who says, "But the path of the just is just like the shining sun that shines even brighter into the perfect day. The way of the wicked is like darkness." We saw darkness in these chapters. "They do not know what makes them stumble." And I think my favorite verses from Isaiah, and you can add your own, I have 6:1, "In that year King Uzziah saw the Lord sitting on his throne, high and lifted up. And the train of his robe filled the temple." And I hope from this study you know what that train really means. It's the one, the lady with the issue of blood touched, and she was instantly healed. It's the mantle that fell over Elisha, and he became the power of Elisha. And then Zechariah got to hold it centuries later and put it on baby John the Baptist. And Jesus says, "And you see Elijah." It's a whole lot more than we ever thought. It's the coat of Joseph that cost him staying with his family, but it also allowed him to save them in Egypt. It's that coat, it's that trademark of God that gives him the authority. And we saw Jesus on that throne, and it says, "I'm God, and I have the garments to prove it, and I have the authority to be sitting on this throne." And Isaiah 6:8, "Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send, and also who will go for us? Then I said, Here am I, send me. And he said, Go and tell this people." And I want you to know that that verse is not really a missionary verse. I started to say that you'll hear missionary conferences talk about that verse. Who? Here I am, send me. Let me tell you what God was sending him to do. Isaiah was willing to go after he saw the temple and he saw the Lord and he's got his lips all burnt and cleaned. And he said, "I'll go." And God said, go to a people that's not going to listen to you, that you're going to tell the story and they're going to reject you, and you go tell them it's done. That's the story Isaiah got to tell his people. But at the very end, he got to tell them there's going to be a remnant left, because I'm going to send a Messiah. I'm going to send Jesus, who you saw on the throne, high and lifted up, and he is going to be your help. Father, we come to you in the name of the Messiah, Yeshua. We thank you for that train in that temple that gives us the knowledge to know he had the authority to be there, that he was just who he said he would, and that in the Trinity of you three, you give us such comfort. Thank you for your word. Thank you that in every verse and every phrase and every word, we see you, we see Jesus. And Lord, let us be ready for your soon coming again. Let us not be weary. Let us not be wane, and let us not waffle, but to stay focused on the truth and righteousness. Keep us righteous, and so that there be no woes against us. We love you. We worship you in Jesus' name. And just before I end, I mean to say this, and I don't always. If there is anyone here that does not know Jesus, if you have the least bit of question, it is time to get that figured out. We see what's coming. We've seen it in every book we've studied, and I think we see it on every television station and every place we look. And I want you to know that Tris and I are here, and we would just love to pray with you. Okay.